Hello and welcome to Nothing Ventured with me, Arish Shah. Today in the studio with me, I had Mads Jensen and Dan Boya, general partners at Superseed. In today's episode, we talked about from boy band and IBM to raising a fund, why there is hunger and interest in AI and how it's going to transform business.
We had 1,600 prospects join this call.
Yeah.
And that's relatively recently. So there is a massive hunger and interest in how AI, which is all over, you know, the standard normal Daily Mail news, how this is going to transform business.
Is there a lack of risk appetite in Europe? How European venture was only $2 to $3 billion a decade and a half ago, we're now 10x of that.
But European venture 15 years ago was $2 to $3 billion a year.
Yeah.
And now it's $20 to $30 billion.
Speed of sale and speed of scale. And do we need a European NASDAQ to solve one of the biggest problems in European venture? Let's get straight into it.
This is Nothing Ventured with me, Arish Shah, the podcast where I talk to the people behind the stories that make the venture capital ecosystem go round. I've been working with startups from pre-seed to Series C for the last decade, and companies that I've worked with have gone on to realize value and exit or raise funds in excess of $500 million. I really hope you enjoy the episode. And if you have a guest that you'd love to see me have on, or you have a comment on any of the episodes that I've recorded so far, do reach out to me on LinkedIn or Twitter. I'd love to hear from you. Let's get straight into it.
Let's kick straight off. So first things first, how did a former pop star and TV show presenter ever get together with a Danish former IBM exec to form a VC fund? I mean, joking aside, you both come from wildly different backgrounds. So what is your co-founder journey?
And so the short version is that we met through a mutual friend who had a small collection of businesses and he was trying to work out what to do with them. And we met and I was running two of the businesses and trying to rescue them and get them back on track. And Mads was working strategically with this chap. And we started spending a lot of time together naturally. And we went, hang on a minute. Why are we doing this for other people? Why are we are completely different people in so many ways and completely the same value set, same drive, same interests around business software and building special things. So we looked at each other one day and went, let's just start a firm.
So it goes back to what we were talking about earlier, the cognitive diversity between that. You may look the same outwardly to other people, but actually you brought different talents to the table.
You have to be greater than the sum of the parts.
Yeah.
You have to be different, but the same and greater than the sum, like any founding partnership.
Yeah. Mads, you remember it the same?
We both love what tech can do, and we both love what startups can do and how startups can transform the world. And we've been on the journey of building our own companies, and we know how hard it is. And we just both have a passion to help other founders build great businesses.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that comes up a lot on this podcast, because we've interviewed a ton of emerging managers, is how difficult it is to actually enter kind of VC, both in terms of the knowledge gap, right? There's a lot of smoke and mirrors around where do you, you know, which jurisdiction do you set up your fund in? What are the requirements around, you know, appointed rep, or do you get your own FCA licensing and regulation? And then, you know, GP commits, how do you go and raise from your first LP? How do you get your cornerstone? Like, so how, talk me through how long the kind of process was and the journey to get from, right, okay, we're going to do this, to actually getting your first fund up, running, and, you know, starting to deploy.
Yeah, I mean, we took a lean startup approach to it, I guess. I don't know whether that's the right thing to do, but we sort of thought, look, let's get in amongst it. Let's, you know, try and get set up, as you say, appointed rep route, get our nominee arrangement set up, make sure we can start raising some money. I think EIS, for all the shtick it gets, I think it sort of enables you to create these rolling funds, which is, yeah, I guess it's a strength in the UK, and you can set up a fund relatively easily compared to if you were sort of going cold GPLP and had a higher cap. And, you know, we used that to set up, you know, and start making some initial investments. I would say it probably took us a year to work out the mechanics and the structures and get the AR status in place. And then it was onwards from there.
Amazing. And I mean, this is your first fund or second fund?
Second fund.
Second fund, right? And do you think the journey got easier as you went out to raise your second fund? And equally, I guess, in the current environment where, you know, certainly in startup world, it is taking slightly longer to raise capital. Not all startups are raising in the same way that they did 21, 22. Do you think it's the same for VCs? Is it harder to go out raise, on a new fund at the moment? Or, you know, are you finding that LPs are sort of saying, right, you know, it's great, we're in it fund two, but, you know, maybe don't come back and talk to us fund three. You may not want to be specific around that, but.
Our second fund is a 22 vintage. Mm-hmm. I think, yes, the market has certainly changed since then, but, you know, we also have a sense that there is capital in the market. You probably have to look a little bit harder to find it and talk to more people. But then it was ever thus, wasn't it, when you have to get off the ramp.
It's always hard. I mean, fundraising is hard. I mean, I think a lot of startups don't realize that VCs have to fundraise. I mean, it feels weird. They look upstream, but forget that we're looking upstream, and often the LPs that we raise from are looking upstream until private, you know, the source of funds. So it's it is a very much this kind of waterfall down. I think it's going to be hard. It is. Fundraising is difficult, and not everyone is going to be a perfect match. And that's a two-way street. Mm. That's not a one-way street. It does feel, and I have no data to back this up, but it does feel like there's a more freer environment since 24.
Interesting.
So the beginning of this year, it feels like some of the conversations that I'm having feel a little bit more fluid.
Yeah, open,
yeah,
less constrained.
And I'm talking more as well as us. We're not fundraising for Fund 3 yet, but we will be this year. And so we've started having those kind of preliminary conversations. Who's doing what? How are you feeling about the market? You know, are we potentially a good match? Those kinds of conversations, the pre-chat.
Yeah.
And with our founders that are doing their Series A and follow-on funding, there seems to be, and I'm hoping this is true when we do go out and fundraise, there seems to be a bit more of a fluidity in the market. I'm not sure much has changed, but it just feels like there's a psychological shift in 24.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think, you know, from what I see and also anecdotally here kind of in the market, I think lots of conversations are happening. I think I think people are having to become a bit more realistic around timeframes, right? So those conversations might be happening over a longer period. Certainly, you know, we're talking to a startup that, you know, we talked to, I think, back in maybe January, maybe even December of last year. You know, they were expecting to close around by February. It looks like it'll probably close in May, you know, so everything's sort of taking that little bit longer. But I think that is testament both to the fact that VCs are doing their jobs, maybe in a way that you know, back in 21, 22 kind of got thrown a little bit out the window.
But keep in mind, there were a lot of VCs that weren't VCs in that time period.
Precisely. Or there were a lot of tourist VCs that were basically just turning up and throwing capital at anything that came along, right? So I think there are, it feels to me like we have gotten back to, okay, let's invest in great companies. Let's not throw money into pretty much anything that comes our way. But that means that whole dance, as you put it, of building the relationship of feeling each other out is naturally happening, over a more prolonged period, as it should, because there's no way over the course of, you know, two Zoom calls and a 1 hour chat in the office, you're going to really have a deep insight into the founder, what motivates them, what motivates the business, how big that business could become. So I think that's actually a really positive take, because most of the emerging managers we've had on are pretty confident about, you know, about their fundraising journey. But often that fundraising journey, you know, if you look at it, it historically has taken a bit longer than they would necessarily.
We'll let you know at the end of the year.
Well,
us back at the end of the year and we'll share what happened.
Retrospective would be good. But look, let's move on. You've been investing in B2B enterprise SaaS businesses at Superseed since 2018. So what do you see changing in that space, especially with like the astronomic development of generative AI, the ability for pretty much anyone to build products to solve their own problems without having to rely on an external solution? What I mean by that is, you know, even me as a small business, let's put it that way, right? I look at all of the SaaS solutions that are out there and I'm like, well, I like a bit of that and I like that bit of that. Actually, I can go and build a microservice for myself and okay, I'm not a coder, but I know enough that I can go on to ChatGPT and get it to write a script and come. I haven't yet done this in a way that's going to be immensely valuable, but I can see that feels like that is going to happen more and more. So
thankfully,
how are you looking at that?
Thankfully, that's not how enterprises think.
That's
not how big businesses can operate, which is obviously, you know, a challenge. Like if you're a small business, I want a bit of this, bit of that, but that's not how So our founders, I mean, I had this question the other day to me, Sid. So surely AI is going to kill SaaS. It's like, well, you're buying AI as SaaS.
Yeah.
So and I'm being a bit bloody minded here, but I mean, it's like, well, it's just, it's a slight shift sideways, but you're still buying a software as a service to run a part of your business.
So in that case, like the SaaS businesses that you guys are looking at, are you seeing them just embrace AI? I mean, I would assume so, but are you seeing them embrace AI in a way that they wouldn't have maybe 2-3 years ago?
Are you talking about our startups or the clients that they serve or both?
Your startups? And then I guess, to like as a proxy, the clients that they serve.
Yeah. I mean, I'll give you one anecdotal story, but they're one of our, actually they've just exited, but one of our portfolio companies, they used to run monthly webinars on what's happening in their industry. And they were in supply chain logistics and working with big FMCG. Hmm. This was possibly 6-7 months ago. They did one webinar on 1 month about ChatGPT and LLMs and how it was going to transform. Their normal webinar attendance list was 30 to 40 prospects. They had 1,600 prospects join this call.
Yeah.
And that's relatively recently. So there is a massive hunger and interest in how AI, which is all over, you know, the standard normal Daily Mail news, how this is going to transform business. So, and I still think there's a lot of hype, noise, and possibly we'll talk about that, but there is a fundamental shift in how businesses are aware of a technology that they know is going to transform what they do.
Yeah. And so have you sort of shifted focus towards those businesses that are more AI led, or are you still sort of open-minded around, you know, if it is a great B2B enterprise sort of SaaS business, irrespective of how much AI is involved, or do you kind of almost see that as a negative mark now?
AI is just next generation software.
Yeah.
I mean, we've been investing in companies that employed some level of machine learning or some level of using data to make your product better since we started. I think a thing that's not always well appreciated is that, you know, you're absolutely right. AI is going to make some SaaS companies less valuable.
Sure.
But what it's also going to do is that because it makes it much easier to build technologies, it's going to enable us to solve a whole suite of new problems.
At lower cost.
Exactly. Yeah. And that is, so, you know, if you think about all the hard to tackle problems in industries like manufacturing, like agriculture, like healthcare, you're going to have massive new TAM emerge, which we think is much bigger than the smaller TAM that might fall away. Mm. So we see this next generation software industry as being, you know, even bigger than what we have now.
Yeah.
And this is all driven by AI.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. Again, you know, you talked about the logistics business, both the one that's exited as one that you mentioned during our quickfire. So I had Renan Devilliers from OSS Ventures on, and he's built a venture studio, which is purely focus on operational business or factory-led businesses. But as part of the conversation, he was talking about Shein, right? The massive Chinese retail business. And the thing that shocked me was that he said their logistics team is 12 data scientists. They've automated it to such an extent that they don't need, you know, people sitting in 3PL warehouses doing X, Y, Z. It's just a seamless. And the obvious thought to me was a bit like Amazon, you know, AWS emerged as a product that was used internally and then became very obviously something that they could sell externally. And it struck me that, you know, Shein could probably do something very similar with that sort of logistics as a service. And I think, to your point, there's probably, you know, lots of untapped markets today, which have either been too difficult historically to approach or too manual or too powered by incumbents, that AI actually loosens up. I mean, obviously, you know, with my background, like the accounting and legal sort of spheres are the obvious ones, right? And we're seeing that. We've had guests on that are, you know, building incredible services within bid tech as an example, right? But that whole shift, I think, what's interesting to me is, you know, those industries that don't adopt and adapt quickly enough are going to have problems, right? Like the industries will adopt. Yeah.
The companies will be in trouble. Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. And so I'd also love to have a broader conversation about the state of venture today in Europe. What's going well? Where do we need to improve? What are the key things VCs and founders need to look out for over the next 12 months and beyond? Because the market has clearly shifted, as we talked about. You know, Dan, your view is that, you know, things are maybe getting a bit better, softening. But yeah, what would you sort of say about the state of venture today?
To me, it's a game of two halves. That's such a cheesy phrase. Bear with me. It feels like there's the American piece and then there's the rest of the world.
Yeah.
We are hyper, I mean, obviously most of our companies go off and sell and raise and migrate over the pond, which I think is a crying shame. Maybe we'll dig into that later. So what is going on in European venture? What would I change? So I get very frustrated with the lack or the fear, the lack of risk appetite, the lack of awareness, the lack of understanding around how these layers of innovation, these kinds of startups that most VCs are investing in fundamentals. They're not doing hypey nonsense stuff. And those days have gone at least for the short term. There is a lack of appetite for that kind of thinking activity in Europe. And I'm generalizing to lose friends here, but it saddens me. And I think it's a challenge, even like with the naming conventions that we have. Why is early stage venture capital called alternatives? There's nothing alternative. It was one of the highest performing asset classes for the last two decades. It's just there's a weird attitude to it. Europe hasn't got the hunger and kind of risk appetite for it, but this is what's going to look after our children. This is what's going to create the next layer of innovation. This is what's going to change the world. And all we're doing is making American pensioners richer. That whole European attitude, I struggle with. We were at an LPGP event not so long ago, I think it was last week, where basically VCs and family offices. And a lot of the family office kind of attitude to us was, well, you haven't made us returns yet. You know, there's not enough going on in the European venture scene for us to be
excited about it. Yeah.
I'm like, well, we need you to kind of invest in us so that we can invest in them and the circle can complete. So it just feels like there's, and I'm talking at the macro here, there's a struggle and a challenge with that kind of attitude, which is the piece that really frustrates me.
To add on to that, I wrote an article recently, hopefully soon to be published in the Evening Standard, around the Future Fund. And really, it was an article that was kind of in response to all of the negative press over the last, you know, whatever, 3-4 months, you know, whether it's Sifted, The Telegraph, whoever, like, oh, look at, you know, 8% of these companies have already folded, or, you know, they're never going to make money back. And I'm just sat there going, well, Jesus, you know, if you look at this from a VC kind of perspective, from a venture perspective, which ultimately these companies were, right? They were essentially externally backed, typically venture, if not angel, well, angel, if not venture backed. And they were in theory, shoot for the moon type of companies, right? And actually, if you look at the numbers, you know, there's still, you know, the Future Fund holds equity positions in 690 of these businesses, yes. Right? Now, you know, if you do the maths and if you look at kind of, you know, the long tail, et cetera, you're talking about maybe 10 or 12 of those. All that needs to happen is if 10 or 12 of those companies pop at a decent value, then actually that's the fund done and taxpayer money returned and all the rest of it. And, you know, a part of the argument was not just on the, you know, in the press, but founders were also saying, well, we took the money and now 3 years on, we got to pay it back and we can't, therefore we're going to. And I'm like, well, but that's what you signed up for. Like, read the contract.
And you've got to look at the opposite side, as if this didn't exist and this didn't happen,
you'd have been dead then.
It would have been a very, very different story.
Yeah.
People don't understand probabilistic thinking. So they don't get power law. They don't get the venture model, which is fine. I get that. Totally understand that. But the other thing that people forget is that these people are in employment. They're creating jobs and opportunities for other people. So forget the recycling part of the, you know, the end point is that these entrepreneurs become the next layer of recycling, become angels, become LPs, investors in funds. Yeah, yeah. Da, da, da. So, but parking that bit for a minute, these small businesses are the lifeblood of the country.
Yeah.
I mean,
there's like 600,000 a year that are kind of launched, right?
So of course we have to kind of support, and yes, some are going to fail, but that's, you know, that's the nature of the beast.
I mean, Mads, again, would you agree? Cause again, like, I always talk about it exactly, Dan, as you said, we seem to be very, very risk averse.
Yes.
In the UK and Europe. We, you know, a lot of the capital, especially at sort of the upstream sort of LP family office type level, is all kind of old family money rather than newly generated. And then again, secondly, we have this issue, if you want to call it an issue, that only 8% of European VCs come from operator backgrounds versus 50-60% in the US. And one would expect that part of the reason for that is because there haven't been sufficient enough founder-led businesses exiting to that level that those founders then decide, yep, you know what, I'm gonna go and start redeploying into new businesses. So would you agree with that kind of assessment that it's a risk problem? Or is there something more broad? Is there a talent problem? Or is it also just the fact that we talk, like, I fall foul of this, we talk about Europe as if it's homogenous, but it's not, right? And that's equally the
neither
other problem.
Neither is the States. The States is 50 countries. Sorry, Mads, I'm going to...
It is, and I agree, but it's 50 countries, but the way you run your option scheme across all those countries is the
yeah,
same.
Yeah, the language you, and the yeah. federal... get that, but it's...
In B2B, and it's one market. No, I think, listen, let me take the other position here, other side for a minute. Mm. It's very easy to be bearish and think about all the bad stuff that's happening. Look, European venture 15 years ago was $2 to $3 billion a year.
Yeah.
And now it's $20 to $30 billion a year. Okay, we have come a long way. Now, we still have much further to go, and the US is definitely ahead, and we have a lot we can learn from and be inspired by. Yes, we need to take more risk. Yes, we need to figure out how to integrate and harmonize more so we can do business more easily across Europe. I think Brexit was a big mess up, and I think that's hurt everybody, both here in London and also on the continent. I think we're better when we work together. But you know, I think we have come a long way as a geography, and I think you know that there's a lot to build on. So I think we should remember that as well.
Yeah. So I think that optimism does often get lost, and I think that's the interesting thing. I think you know within venture, whether you're a founder or a VC, you have to be optimistic. Like, I mean, you know, especially yes. you're investing at pre-seed seed, literally you're taking a bet on, you know, this could work. Not
one
this
up
will
from
work.
The nags, baby. One up from the nags.
maybe there's a little bit more, I would hope, a little bit more data or diligence or decision-making based on factual circumstances than potentially the nags. But yeah, I mean, you have to be optimistic. You have to be thinking that this bet could win, not talk yourself out of it. And I think it's really hard for me coming from kind of the accounting side of finance, not that I've ever been an accountant, you know.
It's you and half of our profession, right?
Well, yeah, but that risk aversion sits there. Like it's fundamentally drilled into you from the day you do your first exams, right? Like everything is about the cautionary principle. Everything is about, ensuring that you take the least risky option. And, you know, if you're preparing accounts, you will always under-declare revenue if it's not certain and over-declare your expenses if they are, you know, that sort of thing. Obviously, you shouldn't be under-declaring or over-declaring anything. Let me be very clear. I'm just sort of trying to make a point here. But yeah, that sort of risk. And again, it comes back to the fact that, you know, 8% of VCs are operators here versus 50-60% in the US. What that suggests is that the balance here in Europe are probably more from that financial background and therefore have that kind of risk aversion baked into their DNA. Is that fair? Without pissing off your fellow VCs, I guess.
Look, I'm sure there is some of that. You know, we need a bigger ecosystem. We need more successful companies. We need more big funds that can do follow-on and help companies grow. We need less of a dependency on the US. Mm. I mean, I love the US. I love doing business there. I build a company there. I work for a big US corporation. We sell, you know, our portfolio companies sell to US customers. We exit our businesses to US buyers. Like we're super long the US. Mm. We can do a lot more of that here. Mm. And it's more. It's more founders, more companies, more teams, more capital, right? More collaboration across the continent. We need to go, you know, optimistically and in a positive way, just go forth. We have a lot to build on.
There is a question that always comes back to my mind as well, because the do more I get, right? But it's do more, quote unquote, the right things. One of the things that I think certainly in the UK makes it slightly more noisy is the SEIS and EIS programs. Because I see a lot of founders that raise SEIS or EIS and use that as a proxy to say, oh, okay, we're on a venture capital track. Whereas realistically, and I had Josh Bell on from Dawn Capital, and he said, you know, of the 70-odd companies within their portfolio, he would doubt that any of them had raised SEIS or EIS, right? And I wonder whether, you know, there is this attitude almost that and I think this plays into some of the negativity that is espoused online about VCs, that everything should get funded by VCs. But when actually, no, by its very nature, very, very small number of companies should attract VC funding. Do you see that sort of noise when you're talking to founders? You see a lot of founders with, okay, good businesses, and there's nothing wrong with a $5, $10, $15 million business. But if they're going to be $100 million, $500 million, $1 billion business, you know, they need to show different sort of skills and opportunities. So do you see that there's a lot of noise in the market around that sort of stuff, or is that just me overthinking?
Yes, there is a lack of awareness in the founder community as to what venture capital is. I think we're conflating SES, EIS, and VC. I think they're two separate conversations.
Sure.
SES, EIS are an amazing thing.
Of course. Or
net amazing. Tick.
Yeah, they allow many founders, entrepreneurs get off the ground.
I love it because that's lifeblood for that next gen. Yeah. The challenge thereafter is that venture capital is not a natural follower, even though it might be a VC or an EIS fund that invested. So there might be an essence of that. But the challenge is that a lot of founders, quite rightly so, aren't studying our industry and don't really know what venture capital is or what it needs. So the lens that I always share with them is like, are you a potential fund returner? Is this potentially a global business? Is this, where are you on the J curve where your venture capital coins are going to fuel this exponential growth? And as soon as they get that, which, I mean, they're smart boys and girls doing this stuff, they go, oh, okay. And I ask them very, very explicitly, and I hammer this home. Do you want to build a venture scale business? Mm. I don't think you should be building a venture scale business. And it's a very different beast. And we go into ownership and the push and what venture scale really means.
And well, it could often mean that you get pushed out of your own company, like within 3 or 4 years, rare. Potentially.
That's rare. But there are a whole host of energetic challenges for founders who have the hardest job on the planet already. Mm. And so I'm extremely raw and candid about what the expectation will be. Raise money from me, us or not, the expectation will be a certain speed of sale, speed of scale. And there's a velocity game here, which is what venture capital is all about. And if you're not on that track, that's absolutely fine. There is nothing wrong, like you just said, selling 15, 20, 50 million pounds. That's a beautiful exit. Rather than owning 1% of whatever, which I'm sure will be massive if you're IPOing on the NASDAQ. But, you know, and it's super rare.
Yeah.
Owning a big chunk and having a very happy lifestyle and spending time with your kids. There is nothing wrong with that.
Yeah.
There's nothing wrong. It's taking the other side of the argument. If we want to do better in Europe, we need to be more ambitious and we need to build more big companies. Mm. And to do that, we need more founders that have the ambition and the tenacity and the grit to go the whole way. Well, so, totally agree with you.
They can do it a second time. They can do it a third time.
When the timing is right.
I met a founder this morning and it's his second go on the merry-go-round. And he realized with his first business, which was a pet insurance business, that it wasn't going to go the full yards. And he wants to build a global, and he's the most ambitious.
Yeah.
Bugger. I was going to swear then.
It's not, you're allowed
most,
to swear.
Most ambitious person.
Yeah.
And I loved him. And he closed the business because it wasn't going to go big enough. And it was a very successful 20,000 user, nice revenue.
But it just wasn't what he wanted to do.
Wasn't venture scale, wasn't global scale.
Yeah.
And he's going again.
I think so there's a couple of points. I think that's really useful context. I mean, the first thing I would say to anyone who doesn't understand venture, watch the podcast, read the newsletter. I talk about all of this stuff all the time. Follow me on LinkedIn. Follow Dan on LinkedIn. He talks about it even more than I do. But the part of the problem surely is that there haven't been enough big, large companies here in Europe, UK, where some of these founders can cut their teeth and actually experience what it means to build that globally scaled business and therefore then go out and say, well, I'm going to do this, because they just haven't had the context. The context, again, not dismissively, but I talk about the UK, you know, Margaret Thatcher's old phrase, you know, we're a nation of shopkeepers. Like, that's the thing that kind of comes back to me. And it's very interesting in my own kind of community. We talk about ourselves as dukavales, like, again, shopkeepers. Like, we're the sort of people that like sitting in our business and, you know, counting every single pound and checking the stock ourselves and doing it all ourselves. But that equally means that if you have that mentality, you can't actually grow and scale necessarily, because at some point you have to be able to trust others to go out and do it and focus on the sort of expansionary side of things. So I wonder whether it is part of that mentality shift that needs to happen is actually not just a mentality shift, but is also driven by the fact that we don't have enough super scaled businesses for these founders to get experience of. And we're going to talk about this in a second. Often those businesses are in the US, right? So a lot of those founders maybe have been part of that ecosystem and then come back and launch.
They're not necessarily Americans though.
No, that's exactly. Yeah.
It's part of it. But I think the other angle is, look, it takes time to build a big company.
Of course, yeah.
And the European venture ecosystem was $2 billion 15 years ago.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so it's growing, and I think it's much bigger today, and we're going to see many more big companies in the next 10 years than we have in the past 10 years, because there's more capital, more founders, more know-how on how to build and how to scale. So, you know, we need a combination of, yes, ambition, and more, because more is better. Mm-hmm. Like, that's just the way this, let 1,000 flowers bloom. It can't work any other way. We also need a little bit of patience. Like, it takes time.
Yeah.
And so I think with the combination of those two, I'm so bullish on European venture. I think we have so much potential ahead.
I think that's such a lovely way of looking at it and being optimistic. And yes, I mean, I always, again, I think, you know, VC was born in the US in the 50s, 60s, whatever.
Got a big head start on this.
Yeah, big head start, but they, you know, but also we're building semiconductors, et cetera, et cetera. I think part of, and I'm sure you guys will definitely disagree with me on this one. What I'm seeing at the moment is, again, a bit of a shift away from pure software and SaaS towards maybe built kind of products, atoms, hardware, deep tech, et cetera. And, you know, a lot of venture capital flowing into those sort of verticals as opposed to necessarily just pure SaaS businesses.
Takes more capital.
Takes more.
It's back to needing more money.
Yeah. So you need more money, and we don't have enough of that, those pools of capital here in the UK. So look, on a related point, and this is with reference to a post that Dan wrote a week or two ago around a white paper written by Phil Robinson from Boardwave, which raised a number of areas where European governments could better support tech businesses this side of the pond. I think there's a question already there as to how involved governments should be, but we'll park that one for now. But with one of the key calls being to support the creation of a European NASDAQ, right? So I was recently at a dinner with a CEO who has sat on a number of listed tech companies here in the UK, and his sentiment, and he's an Aussie, his sentiment absolutely echoed many that we've had on the pod, right? Public markets in the UK and Europe just don't seem to get or be interested in tech. And as a result, It's US investors, to your point, and pension pots that ultimately win. So how critical do you see this issue as being for the ecosystem? And what do you think the impact could be if something of that nature was to be built? And how do we get to that stage where actually it is?
Then you need governments involved. I can't see any way around. I mean, I'll take any head start. If it's SEIS, EIS, other tax regimes, regulation, I'll take any head start. Anything that's going to fuel the fire, I think, is good for me. Mm-hmm. I would love to see, and I have no idea, and I'm going to speak to Phil about this, how we can create a European NASDAQ. But that, I cannot help but think, has to be part of the answer. How big, when, how, I blah, 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 blah. But it has to be part of keeping the recycling, keeping the you know, the money, the opportunity. I mean, it's a ridiculously high-performing asset class, venture capital.
Yeah.
And we are, as I've said before, the net creators of opportunities and jobs and innovation. So why not keep from the grassroots?
The founders.
Yeah, for sure. So get why not keep that full stack? If we can keep that full stack of investment, of recycling, if you look at a lot of the really smart founders that come out of whatever it was Skype in Estonia, there was the Skype trio, I think, that went off and did other things.
Yeah.
And there's the mafia from the Revolut mafia. Then there's the whatever big tech mafia. So we need
Spotify, etc.
We need to keep more of that. And also not just in the tech ecosystem, but in the broader economy. Because everything we're doing in this extremely lucrative stack is spinning out into...
Well, it impacts life on a daily basis, right?
And then why not have European... I'm sure this is a global thing. European pension funds invest in the States. And I'm sure, you know, there's a lot of cross-fertilization in publics, not that I know much about publics, but why not have that in Europe and have our version of that? How is the big question?
So there's a couple of things there, right? So firstly, I mean, part of the problem, and you know, Hussein from Hoxton's talked about this. We've had Neil Shah from the London Stock Exchange Group vehemently arguing against this point. But so you could create the European NASDAQ, right, as an example. But if public investors just don't have the same appetite as they have in the US, and this is always the constant problem, right? If you list in the US, you see that, notwithstanding what's going on with I can't say the name because apparently, you know, we get ticked down on YouTube, but social, you know, if you see what's happened with that, you know, pump and dump happening at the moment. But if we create the European NASDAQ, you still need public investors to buy into that tech narrative. So this goes to your point around educating the wider public as to why this is important and how this solves. And again, also ties back to that kind of risk appetite issue, as well as the broader kind of like people need to understand as an asset class how impactful investing in venture can be. And not only, you know, for you personally, but for those that have worked within the ecosystem. And then allied to that is this whole point around, you know, I talk about on this podcast often, you know, whilst it's not a diversity podcast, as I often say, we talk about diversity quite a lot. Part of the way that you fuel that diversity is by having those exits, because if you have diverse LPs investing in diverse GPs that are investing in diverse founders that are investing in diverse teams that are then really having massive exits and creating, you know, generational wealth, then that recycles through the ecosystem. It's all a net positive sort of incremental circle. But it comes back to the how do we do it, and how do we educate, you know, Joe Public that actually you should be, you know, you should be backing ABC.ai on the European NASDAQ, because, you know,
well,
what,
the narrative around AI is doing that. Just very quickly, one quick point is that there is a new, it was whatever, it was mobile, then it was the social, then, I mean, there are a number of kind of what I would put in the revolutionary pot when it comes to tech rather than the
tech platform paradigms, basically.
So yeah. The AI hype included is going to fuel a lot of the conversations, a lot of businesses, and a lot of people. Just the everyday person in the street knows what ChatGPT is.
Yeah.
So that, I'm confident, is going to create a more open dialogue about the fear. Obviously, there's a lot of fear around what AI is going to do, but that's going to create a lot of the dialogue around tech and therefore investing in tech. So I think that we're moving. I think to Mads's point of there, it's going to take time and we need to be a bit patient. There's been a lot of movement in Europe. I don't know what's going to come first or where the next trigger events are going to be, but I know that AI is going to be a big accelerator across the board, across what we invest in, how we invest in it. There's going to be a big accelerant around the topic of AI that's going to unlock even perhaps the conversation around a European NASDAQ.
Yeah. Mads, would you agree? I mean, do you think we need something like that here in Europe, or do you think it's secondary?
Yeah, I'm not sure what problem it solves. Right. I think you need the investors. You need the capital. And if people aren't willing to invest, the trading platform is just a computer, right? That takes orders and clears the trade. If you analyze it, you break it down. You need the capital. You need the investors that want to allocate. And you need to have the companies they can invest in. And, you know, I think
it's a two-sided market.
It's a two-sided, right? Yeah. I think we're building amazing companies in Europe. Far too often, they're exiting too early to American buyers.
Yeah.
And part of the problem is we don't have a deep enough capital pool to do the follow-on investments here. Mm. In situations where founders, you know, maybe they could get a, you know, fantastic exit to a big US corporate, or they could maybe try and build more and grow more. Mm. And there's just not enough capital for them to do that and scale here. And so they take the exit route. And, you know, we need that extra capital so we can keep building, so we can get the companies to the stage where they can IPO here.
Yeah.
And I think that will fuel the excitement. Mm. But you got to build the companies, and you got to make it easy for pension funds to make the investments so they can backstop that market.
Yeah.
I think those two things are more important than the trading venue.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, one, and we'll talk about this maybe after the pod, but, you know, I'm working quite closely with the outgoing CEO of a business that exited a couple of weeks ago, you know, a very well-known business within the kind of tech ecosystem, certainly here in the UK, 9-figure exit reportedly. So like, you know, decent, but not, necessarily kind of at the billion-dollar valuation that people would hope. But he and I talk quite a lot about this, that here, you know, there are typically not strategic buyers for your business. So the main route for exit for European or UK-based businesses tends to be financial sponsors, so private equity, as opposed to either a strategic buyer or an IPO. So if you're looking for strategic or IPO, you have to go to the US at the moment because there aren't businesses sizable enough to actually acquire these tech companies at the sort of price points that they would like to be acquired at. You can't IPO for all the reasons that, well, you can IPO, but you don't get the same outcomes as you necessarily see, you know, if you do list in the US. And private equity, again, has its own, you know, it has its own problems, right? In the sense that private equity, but they still need to find an exit. Like, there still needs to be some route to creating liquidity for everyone that came, you know, came down the path prior to that. So I guess maybe to kind of top and tail this conversation, when you guys are investing in these, and predominantly European B2B SaaS, right? When you're investing in these companies, is part of your thinking when working with them that we're going to figure out how you can grow scale? And then obviously you are looking for liquidity and exits from these businesses. Do you therefore push them towards kind of the US, or do you look for solutions within Europe?
The starting point is always we want the companies we back to be able to build big independent businesses. Mm-hmm. That's always the plan A, right? And I think it has to be in venture capital. And then more often than not, quite quickly, they'll start to get traction in the US and US marketplaces, US customers. They'll start to have US partners, and then folks start to come knocking.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, every exit we have had has been to a US trade buyer.
Right. Every exit you've had is...
Every single one.
I can't think of one company that is selling in the States.
In venture capital in Europe, we're an export business.
Yeah. Yeah. I had Ennis Hulley from 500 Global, which is part of 500 Startups, he's with 500 Globals, which used to be 500 Startups, but he very much focused on 500 emerging Europe. And his whole take is like, so, you know, he works across Eastern Europe and Turkey, and all the companies that he invests in have to be UK or West first, right? Like, they have to be structured to be able to deal with working with the US, with maybe Germany, with maybe the UK, because he knows that that is the only opportunity ultimately for them to really grow and scale to the point where they're going to be either fund returners or certainly valuable businesses. And I guess it becomes a really circular conversation because, okay, if everyone's exiting in the US, then we don't have those strategic buyers in the UK. You know, if I don't know, arguments sake, you know, you had, I don't know what's a good example, but, you know, let's say your logistics business grew so big that it was able to actually IPO here in the UK and do really well, then one would hope that that actually becomes a force attractor for other businesses that are building in this space and potentially, you know, can look to someone on home turf. And then you start seeing that movement. Whereas at the moment, the default is everyone just heads to the US because it's easier.
Arish, it's going to happen.
Okay. Mad's the eternal optimist. Like, no, I love it. I mean, like, I want to see it happen. You know, certainly from my perspective, you know, the businesses that we work with, we want to see them have incredible outcomes and we'd love to have them here. Because I mean, apart from anything else, if they move to the US, they're going to find a US CFO. But I mean, joking aside,
because there is a bigger
you
context.
Want to see that success.
Yeah, there is a bigger context, right? You know, the US is with 330 million people today, and Europe is 500 million people.
Yeah,
but the US economy is bigger.
Yeah,
25 trillion versus 23 trillion here.
Mm.
And over the last two decades, they've increased productivity 20% more on a per hour work than we have.
Mm.
So they're accelerating further away from us.
Yeah.
And if we don't get this tech thing right, we're just going to be left behind.
We're going to be behind. And it'll be China and the US.
Oh, totally. Totally. Yeah, we have to make this work.
Yeah. Yeah. Amazing. Mads, Dan, it has been really wonderful having you here in the studio with me. And it was lovely to meet you in person for the first time. For our listeners, for our audience, where's the best place for them to find you online? You're on LinkedIn, Twitter. Where can they find you?
Superseed.com.
Yep.
LinkedIn, Dan Bowyer.
Okay. Mads?
Yeah, same.
Okay, amazing. Well, look, thank you so much for joining me. It's been a blast. And really enjoyed the conversation.
Likewise. Thanks for having us.
Thank you.